Hello, this is Gary Cleveland with Helicopter Online Ground School. This is a podcast made from our live Tuesday training event where Taz Chrisman, Instructor of the Year, gives us some tips on common instrument check ride mistakes from his experience with helicopter instrument check rides. Kenny Keller invites you to visit www.helicopterground.com, where we have four FAA-certified courses, private pilot, commercial pilot, instrument pilot, and certified flight instructor pilot. Enjoy your podcast.
Hey, it's Kenny with helicopterground.com. I want to say hello to everybody here. We're getting ready to do our instrument common mistakes with Taz Chrisman. We're going to go to his camera in just a second. I'll go ahead and say hi to everybody while we check, make sure we have good audio and video. Let us know if you have any trouble hearing or seeing us. We have Juanita Falk here every week, joined March 1st, 2012. One of our longest members ever. Ben Gillespie, hello everyone. Kevin McCombs is here, he's here every week. Paul G, he's in almost here every week. Marcus from San Antonio. Paul G, Brian Bay, hello from Las Vegas. I bet that somebody Taz knows.
You know. Hey, Brian.
Taz says, hey, Brian. We'll go to his camera in a minute. Sam Daughtry, Sellersburg, Indiana, on the road today from New York City. Nice. Rex Jester. Hey, guys. Rex from Cordova, Tennessee. Ben Gillespie, loud and clear. Awesome. Rex, audio and video is very good. Mark, hello from Mark in KFSD. Awesome. That's what we wanted. Good audio and video. We get better every week. So, We're gonna get started with Taz's. Merry Christmas to you, Rex, and hello, Brian. Again, he says hello, Taz. So we're gonna get to Taz's presentation in a minute. Try to hold your questions more towards the end. If you like, go ahead and let us know who you are and where you're from. That's cool. But maybe you'll have an instrument-related question that Taz covers before he gets done, and then start typing them in near the end, and then I'll make sure I keep a list, and we'll try to get everybody's questions answered regarding a helicopter check ride. So let's go over to Taz's camera, just make sure he's working.
Hi, everybody.
And then to show you that this is the Christmas edition, let's go to Chief Pilot Gary Cleveland.
Hello, Merry Christmas. This will be our last show before Christmas, so we have a special holiday coupon that you can put in the coupon box on checkout if you need another membership or you're not a member yet. Enjoy the program. We're privileged today to have Taz in town. So, do you have any more to say over there? I'll move to your camera. Or?
Yeah, I want to come back. Yep.
Okay.
And just...
There we go. I want to mention, catch up here. Alan Bieberstein, hello from Canada. Alan, another longtime member who's remained a member, and he uses our training to stay current, owns his own aircraft, comments a lot. So he's here. That's awesome. Alan, you're here. Levi, we were just chatting with Levi last night. Levi just joined. He just bought the new remote book yesterday and got the remote course. Bonnie Seymour, Dean here. Dean is the one you've seen in one of our videos. He was like the most prepared student we've ever had. Showed up and had every single book, and he'd had like 1 hour flight time. So we have a video on him that's quite a people have watched and made comments on, because Dean is like the most prepared student ever versus showing up with nothing. Dean shows up with everything that a person needs. So that was a good video. Dave Faulkner, who was here in the studio with us a few months ago. Thank you, Dave, for letting us know. Helicopter pilot, flew law enforcement, chief pilot, now retired, and I believe, Dave, aren't you working on your instrument? Or did you get that instrument done? Let us know about that. Paul says, hi, Taz. So,
hi, Paul.
Merry Christmas to everybody and all of you, too. So, I think we'll go to Taz's camera, and was there anything else I need to say before we get Taz going?
When we start showing some of his slides, speak up if the audio's not working, but I believe we have it installed properly.
Okay, yeah. Hopefully we got everything going. Just I'm monitoring comments today. Gary's running cameras. I'm taking care of the comments so Taz can focus on presenting. Oh, yeah, and I wanted to mention, we're wearing Airwork Las Vegas shirts today. Taz brought one for me and Gary, and today Taz is wearing his Helicopter Ground School shirt that we just got him. So, I wanted to mention Airwork Las Vegas. We appreciate everything that Taz does for us, and that he works for Eric Work Las Vegas, and that they allow him to be a guest instructor here. So if you need flight training for helicopters in the Vegas area, you need to see Air Work Las Vegas. And do you guys do fixed wing too?
We do, yep.
Fixed wing and or helicopter training in the Vegas area, Air Work Las Vegas, that's where you need to go. All right, well, let's get rolling with Taz's presentation.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Kenny and Gary. Thanks for having me here. Today, what we're going to be talking about is instrument check ride mistakes. Now, getting this prepared, I talked to two helicopter DPEs as well as two airplane DPEs on what the most common mistakes that they've seen from applicants during the check rides. And I narrowed those down to what we're going to see here is seven major mistakes that they've been knocking the students out with on here. So we'll go through most of those. Some are pretty easy for people to fix, and then other ones are going to be something I'm going to dive a little bit more into, give you a couple of my my techniques on it, and we'll go from there. All right, so we'll keep on going here. So these are the seven big ones that I saw. Weather theory and weather regulations, improper step downs, alternate airport procedures, holding, GPS in lieu of DME, and descents from MDA or DAs to the runway. All right, so we're gonna start out with weather and weather theory. So obviously as instrument pilots, you're gonna be spending a majority of your time in the clouds. So it's a good idea to have a good background on understanding what the weather's gonna do. Not just where you're at right now, but where you're going and what you can expect. And what you're gonna see here is most students have no problem reading the actual textual weather. The reports, so the METARs, TAFs, so they're very good at regurgitating exactly what those METARs and TAFs say, but they have a problem understanding exactly what it's telling them. Not necessarily the METARs, because that's right now, they can look outside and kind of tell what it is, but the TAFs, knowing the, you know, the time frames that they're looking for and how that's going to affect their alternates as well as their departure and arrival areas. So some of the biggest ones that all the DPEs actually told me about, I talked about the terminal aerodrome forecast there, the TAFs, but weather charts and graphical weather products. So understanding where to get those and what they're actually telling you. All right. So with that being said, what you're seeing here is if you go into the AIM in Chapter 5, Section 1, Pre-Flight, it gives you three ways to get an approved weather briefing. The first one is 1-800-WX-BRIEF, so that's the old standard telephone that you call, pick that up, and you're going to get a hold of a Lockheed Martin guy, and they're going to give you the standard weather briefing. The second one is going to be duots.com, all right? So same type of stuff that you're going to get from a pre-flight briefer at the flight service station, but it's all going to be textual, and you can get it yourself. You can print it out. You can download it, put it on your iPad or whatever and fly with it. And then the third one that's just out probably about 2 years ago is 1-800-WX-BRIEF.com. This was originally by Lockheed Martin, same people that do the 1-800-WX-BRIEF, the phone conversation guys, but now it's by Laredo's. Same type of stuff, though. Big thing here, what this is going to give you, the reason why these are the three approved ones, is it's going to give you this stuff right here. This is your standard weather briefing, all right? And I use the acronym Sacred Wind. You can see how it goes down here. But it's going to give you the synopsis of the weather, the adverse weather conditions, current weather, en route forecasts, your destination, terminal forecasts, winds alofts, and NOTAMs. So those are all the standard things that you're going to get in your weather briefing. The other thing that it's going to give you is these are all recorded. So they're either recorded or it's, you know, when you do duots, you put your information in and it's recorded. So there's a record of you actually getting a full weather briefing. So not that something's going to happen to you, but if something does later on, then go back and see if you actually got a weather briefing. All right, so these are the three big ones. This is where your examiners are expecting you to get your weather briefing, your actual, no kidding, weather briefing. Now, with that being said, if you watch our instrument presentations that I've done for the Instrument Ground School, you'll see me using this aviationweather.gov website quite a bit. And this is acceptable. This is, you want to use it with in conjunction with the approved sources. So this is good to get background information. They have a lot of good weather products that you can get off this website. But the AIM actually goes in and after 7, it says, 7.1-3, it's talking about use of aviation weather products. So it's talking about other stuff. And it says that you can use any other aviation weather product as long as you use it in conjunction with the approved source. Now, if you actually look, if you go to the Aviation Weather Center webpage and you go to the standard weather briefing, it's going to give you this disclaimer right here. It actually tells you the same information that's in the AIM, that is, you can use this, but it's not approved for an actual weather brief. So I get that a lot from the DPEs. They're saying that people are going here and trying to say that this is their weather briefing. So remember, so three at the beginning, you can use this as supplemental information. This is a great web page. Once you get that standard weather briefing, if the examiner asks you a question about, say, a weather synopsis chart or something like that, you can go pull it up on this web page and you can get that, and it works out pretty good. For your check ride, remember, those three approved ones are where you're going to get. All right. All right. Regulation seems to be the other big showstopper for your instrument written or your instrument rating. The DPEs say that most of the students are very good at knowing the instrument flying handbook and the instrument procedures manual. But there's a whole list of other regulations and information in the AIM that they completely gloss over. So what I've done here on the side, on the right-hand side of your screen here, I got a whole list. I'll give this to Kenny so he can upload this to the HOGS site or whatever. But it gives you a list of all the FARs, the NTSB 830, all the AIM chapters and associated material for your instrument rating. So this is good for your instrument and your double eye. All right. And what you're going to see is a lot of this is in the AIM. So a lot of the information that's in the airplane flying or the instrument flying handbook and the instrument procedures manual is also covered in the AIM. The AIM goes more in detail on some of the things, like specifically holding, how to do the wind corrections and stuff like that you're not going to get in the instrument procedures manual. All right. So I'm not going to go through all these. That would take us several hours. So I'll make this available, but if you're going for your instrument rating, use this list as a study guide of what you can go, what you need to be studying. All right, that's the regulations piece there. All right, the next one that a lot of the students are missing is improper step downs. Right now, the big one that they're saying is students are holding a buffer, which is fine because they don't want to bust that minimum altitude, right? But realize outside that final approach fix, the PTS gives you plus or minus 100 feet. So some students are saying, well, it's an at or above altitude. So you can see on the Will Rogers UR17 here. Let's see if I can bring this over here. So let's say you're outside the final approach fix right here. So you got your Maltese cross, that's your final approach fix, and it says 3,300 feet. So outside that final approach fix, the 3,300's only got a line underneath of it. So that means that's a hard altitude at 3,300 feet. You can be above it, so they don't want you below it. All right, so what students will do is they'll hold it, say, at 3,500 feet or 3,600 feet. They're still above it, that's fine, and they're working their way down. But what happens is now when you get to that final approach fix, you might not be able to meet the step down restriction for the next step down, or you might have to have an excessively aggressive descent. Now, not necessarily on this one, but on some of the other ones. So this is something that they're seeing, all right? The other one they're doing, remember, like I said, it's plus or minus 100 feet. So if you go right down to that 3,300 feet, if you dip down to, you know, 3,290 or something like that, you're still gonna be within that 100 foot tolerance, so they're not gonna bust you, all right? But once you get inside this final approach fix here, this Maltese cross, and you step down, now that's this 2,300 one right here, what they're gonna do is now it's minus zero to plus 100. So you can be 2,200 feet and be fine. 23 or 2,290, not necessarily that busts that minus zero. But remember, it's, you can go down that, if you bust through it, that's fine as long as you make a corrective action to get back up. All right, an immediate corrective action. All right, you're not staying down there. What some of the DPEs were saying is, though, so some of the students will come down and they see their MDA, your minimum descent altitude, in this case is 2,300 feet. If you don't have DME, if you do have DME, you can go down to that 1680. And what students are doing is they're staying high. So let's say they're at that 2,500, they're staying at 2,500 feet. They don't want to bust that 2,300 on their check ride. Now when they get to that missed approach point, that 3.4 DME for your missed approach, what's happening is they're too high, so they're not actually down low enough to actually be at the MDA. So they might not break out. If they've got, if you have DME here, you can see the minimums are 400 foot. So if the ceiling's right at 400 feet and you're staying at 500 feet, you're never gonna break out of the weather. And the DPEs are seeing that and they're saying, well, look, yeah, it's plus 100 feet, but you're not meeting the intent of the PTS. You're not descending down to that 1680 for the DME mins there. All right, so make sure that when you're doing this, step down, hold a 50-foot buffer or something like that. That's plenty. As an instrument pilot, you should be able to precisely manage that. And there again, if you momentarily go below that 1680, say you drop down to 1670, but you make an assertive correction to get back up to that 1680, they're going to be fine with that, all right? All right. Next one. So this is another big one that we're seeing, or all the DPs are talking about, is alternate airports. So a lot of people get confused on alternate airports. So the question is, when is an alternate airport required? The answer is always. Now, if you read the regulation 91-169, it says that when you're filing an IFR flight plan, you must include an alternate airport unless you can meet paragraph A2 of this section. All right, so if you look, exception is, yeah, A2. Coming on down for helicopters, so this is all section A1, so it says 2, appropriate weather reports, weather forecasts, or combination of them indicate the following. So for helicopters, we go down here to the highlighted piece, and you're gonna see it says, at estimated time of arrival, and for 1 hour after the estimated time of arrival, the ceiling will be at least 1,000 feet above the airport elevation, or at least 400 feet above the lowest applicable approach minima, whichever is higher, and the visibility will be at least 2 statute miles. All right, so you always have to have an alternate unless the weather says this and there's a published approach procedure. All right, so that's what you're looking for. That's when you need an alternate. All right, so let's take a look at this guy right here. So here's Kalamazoo up at Battle Creek International. All right, this is the ILS localizer 3.5. So I gave you some weather here. So like I said, you got the weather there at Kazoo on the 16th day at 0253 Zulu. Winds are 230 at 9 knots. 2 statute miles with light snow. Overcast at 2100 feet, broken at 1100 feet, scattered at 900 feet. Temperature is -2, dew point is -4, and the altimeter is 2989. So the answer, or the question is, do we need an alternate? Well, we've got a published approach, right? So now we gotta see if it meets that 1,000 or 400 foot. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna look up at the top, find our airport elevation. So right there, you can see it's 874 feet. Do the quick math, add 1,000 feet to that, and you're gonna get your 1874. Right there, all right? So the weather has to be at least better than 1874. Or we go down to the lowest approach minimums and add 400 feet to it. So we can go down here and we can look at our ILS, provided the ILS is in service, so it's 1068. Add 400 feet to that and you're gonna get 1468, all right? So now the highest of those is what we're gonna use to see if we need an alternate, right? In this case, it's 1874 is gonna be our highest. So we look over here at the weather. Do we have a ceiling that's lower than the 1874? We sure do. We got a broken layer at 1100 feet, all right? So remember, a ceiling is anything that's a broken or overcast layer. All right, so in this case, broken is at 1100 feet. So do we need an alternate? Absolutely. All right, so there you go. There's the weather at the time of arrival until 1 hour after the estimated time of arrival. So then obviously you look at the TAF as well and make sure that it's gonna stay that way. All right, so now that we know we need an alternate, how can you select an actual alternate itself? So back at 91-169, it talks about what the procedures are for an alternate. Well, we're gonna go through a bunch of those here. So if you have an alternate not authorized, so at the top of the IAP, you see this little A, which means it's got non-standard alternate minimums with an NA after it. That means that it's not authorized. That procedure is not authorized for you to select that airport as an alternate. All right, doesn't mean the airport cannot be used as an alternate, you just can't base it on that approach. All right, so then you go look down here. So like I said, the non-standard alternate minimums. So you look at the top of the IAP, the instrument approach procedure, and if it has that triangle with the A in it, then it means that it has that you can use it as an alternate, but there's non-standard takeoff or non-standard approach requirements there. All right, so and that's at the beginning of your terminal procedures publication, your book with all the approach plates in it. And then you have your standard alternate minimums. So straight out of 91-169, it says weather at ETA has a ceiling of at least 200 feet above the minimum for the approach to be flown and visibility of at least one statute mile, but never less than the minimum visibility for the approach to be flown. All right. So if you're going to qualify an airport as an alternate and it does not have the ANA or the A symbol there at the top of it, then you this is the minimums that you're looking for, all right, to be able to file it. And then you can see down at the bottom there, no instrument approach procedure has been published. So if there's no approach procedure being published, the ceiling of visibility has to be those that allows a descent from the MEA approach and landing under basic VFR. So that means you're gonna be at that minimum en route altitude and you're gonna descend out of the clouds and be able to land at the airport, VFR basically. All right. So let's take a look. So how do you select a suitable alternate? So here's at the top of your approach plates. So here's what the ANA looks like. This is at Plymouth here. So we can't use the VOR-10 to use Plymouth as an alternate. Then we go over to Warsaw here, and you can see it's got an A in it. All right, so that means it's got non-standard alternate minimums. You go to the front of the book, and what's going to tell you is at Warsaw Municipal, for the VOR runway 9 right here, it says it's not applicable, so you can't use this approach to qualify it as an alternate when the local weather is not available. So if the AWAS is out of service, you can't use this as a as an alternate airport. So you look at your NOTAMs, part of your standard weather briefing, and if it's saying that the AWAS or the ASOS is out of service, you can't use this one as an alternate. All right, so let's look at this airport here and see if it qualifies as an alternate. A lot of applicants get this get confused, so they know that we're filing an alternate and we have to use that 200 foot and 1 mile minimum for the alternate. That's to make sure that the airport can be used as an alternate. But that's not the minimums that you're going to use to fly the approach, right? So let's say you go to your destination airport, you do the missed approach, the weather was worse than it was forecast, you can't land, you have to go to your alternate. So now you're going to your alternate, you filed it because the weather was better than that 200 feet and 1 mile, or whatever the non-standard alternate minimums are. But now you get there, and let's say that the weather is only 100 feet above your minimums. Or whatever, can you still use that? Absolutely you can. All right, so now you're flying to the actual minimums of what's on the approach plate itself. So let's take a look at this one. So what minimums are we gonna use? So we can look at this one here. So here's Kansas City, Missouri, Charles B. Wheeler, downtown, ILS localizer, runway 3. You can see it's got the A up at the top of the approach plate. So we're going to go to the front of that book and look and see what that actually means. So right here it's telling us that we can see all of the different approaches they have in there. We're looking at the ILS localizer runway 3. It's got the little number 1, so we're going to come over here to where it's got the number 1 and we're going to read what it says. It says categories A and B, 902. So what that means is this airport requires a 900 foot and 2 mile visibility for the to be qualified as an alternate. All right, so just like it says right there. All right, this is the weather we need to be able to file this as an alternate, not that 201. For whatever reason, you might have high obstructions out there or whatever they're saying for this for these categories, you have to have that better weather. All right, so that's pretty high weather minimums. It's almost VFR. All right, so. So the weather required to fly the approach would be the weather that's listed at the bottom of the approach plate. So in this case, all right, so let's say we file it 902. We have to go missed approach at our destination, and we fly over here to Wheeler, and it's less than 902. That's fine. Now we have to shoot it using these minimums here, the 300 foot and 3/4 of a mile, all right? So that's what we're actually, if it's less than that, then we can't shoot the approach, right? But in this case, 300 foot and 3/4 of a statute mile, and we can now shoot that, all right? here's some what ifs. What if that glide slope is in op and we can't use this 994 foot MD or decision altitude and the 300 foot and 34? Now we have to shoot the localizer, which requires us a 900 foot weather minimum and one in, was it 3/4 of a mile visibility. All right, so in this case, what we're gonna end up doing is we take that 902 and we look at that and say, okay, well, this is 900 foot, and to actually qualify it, so we get our NOTAMs and they say the glide slope's out of service. We can't use that ILS minimums anymore. We're gonna have to use the localizer minimums. So the lowest approach in this case would be that 900 foot. We're meeting that, but it's saying the 1 mile and 3/4. Well, now we have to make sure that it has the 2 miles. All right, so that's what we're looking for there. So now let's say if we have DME, now we can go down here to the 701, right? Or the 501 quarter. So in this case, let's say we have DME, the glide slope's out of service, and we want to do that 902 statute miles for the non-standard alternate minimums. We look at this, and whatever the minimum is, so if we go to the 901 1/4 without the DME, so we don't have DME, we have to maintain that 900, we have to add the 200 foot to that and the 1 mile. Well, we already got, so in this case it would be 1100 foot and 1 1/4 mile is what we would need for our alternate minimums. But now we got the DME, so we go down here, add the 200, it's only 700 foot, that 902 takes precedence. So it's kind of confusing, but the big thing to look at here is if it's standard, or if you're using the non-standard alternate minimums, you have to do that 902 or the 200 foot above. So in this case, if the glide slope's out of service, you would have to apply that 200 foot above that 900, and then you could do the 1100. All right. I know it's confusing. We're going to record this. You can play it back later and go over it as many times as you want. If you have questions, you can ping us and we can go over it too. You can see why students miss this all the time. All right.
A little break. If you want to go check out our instrument course, go to joininstrumentpilot.com, and that's where you can find the course and current options for join that membership. So that will work. So if you want to go back to Taz, people are making comments. They like your presentation. So
cool. All right.
Just keep going.
All right. All right, I'm gonna try and get through some more of the stuff. So obviously the alternates, that's one of the big ones. The other one is gonna be holding, all right? So I'm gonna go through what the AIM talks about here, and then I'm gonna give you the TAS tech here on how to do this, all right? So holding may seem to be straightforward procedure, instrument flying, but many applicants lose orientation when approaching the holding fix and turn in the wrong direction. All right, this was one of my issues when I was an instrument student way back in the day, and it's still, you know, even when I was as a seasoned pilot, you still have to sit there and think about it, right? Anyway, we'll go through this here. The controllers, when they anticipate a delay at a clearance limit fix, they're going to issue you a holding clearance at least 5 minutes before you get to the ETA of that clearance limit fix, all right? And they're going to give you six different things, all right? What it's gonna give you is they're gonna give you a direction to hold from the fix, name of the fix, the course, or the radial they want you to hold on, the leg length, if it's appropriate, direction of turns, if left hands are required, and the EFC time, so they expect further clearance time, all right? That direction of turns, so standard turns are gonna be right-hand turns, all right? Left-hand turns are non-standard, so in your clearance, if they do not give you a turn direction, you can expect that it's gonna be standard turns to the right. You can see I got asterisks on three of those there, right? Those asterisks are for if it's a charted hold, all right? So let's say you're en route on a Victor Airway or something like that, and there's a charted hold, and they want you to hold at that charted hold. All they have to do is give you those three things: the direction to hold from that fix, the name of the fix, and the EFC time. That's it. If they're making one up, they have to give you all six of those things. All right, so entry procedure is given in the AIM evolved from extensive experimentation under a wide range of operational conditions. The standardized procedure should be followed to ensure that an aircraft remains within the boundaries of the prescribed holding airspace. That's a lot of words saying that all the controllers really care about is that you get into the hold and you stay on the protected side of where they're telling you to go. All right, how are you going to do that? Well, the AIM has a specific way they do it. All right, this is the AIM technique. All right, they divide the hold holding airspace up into three sectors. There's a 70 degree sector, 110 degree sector, and 180 degree sector. And then from that, you can determine what kind of hold that you're going to use or what kind of entry into the hold. All right, so we'll go through each one of these and then I'll talk a little bit more about each one in particular. All right, so here's a parallel procedure. All right, so what they're saying in this case is you're coming in from sector A, right along here, right? You're gonna hit your holding fix and you're gonna parallel the inbound. So normally, their hold is gonna follow around here like this, right? It's the racetrack, this is a standard hold to the right. So as a parallel entry, you're gonna come in to the holding fix right here, and you're gonna parallel that inbound radial outbound. So you're gonna go hit this, you're gonna start your 5Ts, 6Ts, whatever you're gonna do, and then you're gonna go outbound for 1 minute. At the end of a minute, you're gonna make a left-hand turn, so a turn in the opposite direction of the hold, and you're gonna make a left-hand turn in this case, and re-intercept that inbound course or proceed direct to the fix if you want. Either one of those, all right? And then once you get inside that, now you're gonna just enter the holding pattern, all right? And you're just gonna maintain that 1 minute leg inbound is what you're trying to do. For the teardrop procedure, coming in from sector B over here, so this is the 70 degree sector, you're gonna fly directly to the fix. You're gonna hold a 30 degree course intercept here, so basically 30 degrees from whatever your inbound or your outbound leg is gonna be. And at the end of 1 minute, you're gonna make a turn inbound and proceed direct to that fix. Then the direct entry, this is the easiest one because you're already conveniently aligned with the holding fix. So anywhere in this 100 or this side over here, come straight in, you're going directly to the fix, you're just gonna hit the fix and start a turn and right into the holding pattern. All right, now that all sounds very easy, right? The problem is the way the AIM and the instrument flying handbook teaches it, it's from a bird's eye view. It doesn't really give you that three-dimensional picture. So the best way to do it, I'll give you my technique here, is I'm gonna use my heading indicator. And I'm gonna call it a rule of thumb, all right? And the reason why I call it a rule of thumb is because I'm gonna use my thumb to figure out what my entry is for this, all right? And the way I'm gonna do that is I'm gonna draw an imaginary line across my heading indicator. All right? This works good if you have an HSI, it doesn't matter, whatever your heading indicator is. I'm gonna draw a line directly across that case there. I'm gonna place my thumb at the 90 degree point, right? So like I said, rule of thumb, right? So in this case, they say right hand turns, I'm gonna put my thumb on the right hand side of the case, and then what I'm gonna do then is I'm gonna draw a diagonal line across the case. So you can see it divides it up now into thirds, all right? And then I'm gonna draw a vertical line, and what that's doing, my thumb is basically giving me a 70 degree offset, all right? So you can see from right there, so this is setting up my 70 degrees. This is a little bit exaggerated just for the effect, but it basically it sets up about 70 degrees off here. Sets up my teardrop entry area, my parallel, and my direct, all right? And then what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna overlay when they give me my holding instructions. I'm gonna pretend that my holding fix is right here in the middle of my heading indicator. And wherever my holding pattern is, that's the type of entry I'm gonna use. All right, I'll give you some examples here. All right, here's what it looks like. This is my right hand thumb. If it's a non-standard, I use my left hand thumb because I'm gonna do a left hand turn. Same type of procedure over there. What I'm gonna do is I'm gonna superimpose those holds. You can see here, if it's a standard hold and the majority of the holding pattern is down here in the direct, I'm gonna fly up to it. I'm just gonna make a turn and enter the holding pattern. If it's a parallel, so majority of that hold is over here in the parallel sector, come up to the holding intersection here, and then I'm gonna parallel that and then go outbound for a minute and then turn back in, right? Just like we talked about earlier. Same with the teardrop. So let's do a couple of these, all right? So I set this one up here. So we're flying a heading of due north, so 360 or zero there. And then the controller gives us a hold here. So they say hold east of the Knox VOR on the 090 radial. Left turns, maintain 5,000 feet, expect further clearance at 2117 Zulu, time now is 2100 Zulu. So you got 17 minutes you're gonna hold in that racetrack.
I'll point out while you're taking a breather there and getting a drink, Taz, that joininstrumentpilot.com is down below in the description box on YouTube, so you can always go down there and find it, along with some other links for different things. And If you haven't subscribed to our YouTube channel yet, do that for us, because we're almost at 10,000 subscribers. We're, this morning earlier, we were like 9,960 something. 10,000 is a big goal for us. If you would subscribe and do us a favor for all the content that we put out, we really appreciate it, because 10,000 is just a cool milestone for us. We've been chasing it for 7 years now with this channel. You know, some people get 10,000 in a month, but for us, it's taken us a while to get there. But there's some benefits that we get for having 10,000 subscribers, like live help from YouTube when you need assistance with something. So we ask that in return for all the free content that we put out, please subscribe to our channel, like this video, and you can find that Join Instrument Pilot down in the box below. So, gave Taz a little break there. You ready to go back to it?
Sure. Let's get this hold on.
All right. We'll go back to you.
All right. Cool. Got my drink there. So what I'm going to do is they gave me this hold, so I charted it. You know, wrote that down, and then I'm going to pretend that holding fix is right in the middle of my heading indicator there. I'm going to draw my 90 degree radial out of that. So nice thing about your head indicator, it shows you where all your radials are, right? Remember, radials radiate out from that nav aid. All right, so what I'm gonna do is the 90 degree radial is coming out this direction. They told me left-hand turns, so that means once I'm inbound going and establishing the hold, all my turns are gonna be to the left. So I'm going inbound, I'm holding east of the VOR, so this would be east of the VOR on this side. It's non-standard turns, so it's going to be a left-hand turn. So I'm going to be doing left-hand turns like that. All right. So there's my racetrack. Now, if I use my rule of thumb, put that up there, and I can draw my teardrop. They said left-hand turn, so I'm going to use my left hand or my left thumb. Put it over there, draw my line. You can see a majority of that holding pattern is in the parallel sector. So what that means is if I stay on this heading, my 360 heading comes straight up this direction. I'm going to hit that. Hit my intersection right here, and then I'm gonna parallel, I'm gonna make a turn to the right and parallel out outbound for 1 minute. At the end of 1 minute, I'm gonna turn inbound and then establish myself in the hold. All right, so that's the easiest way to see that. All right, I got a couple more for you here. So it says hold west of the Knox VOR on the 270 radial, 10 DME fix, left turns, maintain 7,000 feet, expect further clearance at 2217Z, time now is 2200Z. All right, so in this case, I'm flying a 300 degree heading. They want us on the 270 radial, and we're gonna hold west. So remember, it's not, here's the VOR, west is gonna be up here, right? This doesn't necessarily mean north because it's the top of the case. It's direction dependent. So I'm gonna draw my line there. It's gonna tell me, okay, there's my 270 radial, and it's gonna be left-hand turns, right? So that means everything's gonna be left-hand. All right, use my rule of thumb. You can see there, it's clearly in the teardrop sector. So I'm gonna be coming up this direction and maintain a 30 degree offset. At the end of 1 minute, I'm gonna turn inbound. Convenient here, so here's my 270, here's my 30 degree. I'm already on my 30 degree intercept. I'm just gonna hit that fix. Time for a minute, at the end of a minute, I'm gonna turn inbound and be established in my hold. All right, last hold question here. So hold south of cleft intersection on the 170 radial, maintain 5,000 feet, expect further clearance at 0517Z, time now is 0500. So here you go, here's our fix, 170, so my line's, line's gonna come out there, so there's my 170 degree radial. They didn't give me a turn direction, so that means it's gonna be right-hand turns, right? So it's gonna be looking like that. All my turns are gonna be to the right. Do my rule of thumb, clearly puts it in the direct, so I'm gonna hit my fix, make a right-hand turn, and I'm already established into the hold there. That's the biggest issue people have is actually getting established into the hold itself. Once you get in the hold, it's pretty easy to fly right-hand turns, left-hand turns, timing for a minute, adjusting your inbound leg for winds and all that kind of stuff. All right, the next one that students have issues with is GPS in lieu of DME, right? So this is right out of the Instrument Flying Handbook, the AIM, it's in the AC90-108. How do you actually use GPS for DME? Not all aircraft nowadays have DME. Most airplanes have GPS nowadays. If it's an instrument airplane, it probably has GPS, because that's what a majority of what aircraft are going to. So you don't necessarily need DME anymore to fly approaches. GPS can be used in lieu of it. But there are some things that you have to be able to do with that GPS for it to count as DME. I highlighted here on the slide some of the more important ones. you can read all of this if you want, but the big things I want to highlight here, here in number two it says, if the fix is identified by a five-letter name, that is contained in the GPS airborne database. All right, select either the name fix as the GPS waypoint or the facility establishing the DME fix as the active waypoint. So that's probably the one of the biggest things that you have to be able to do. All right, so that identifier has to be in the database. You can't make it up, you can't put in the lat and longs and call it up or make your own based on the ranging or anything like that. It has to be in the database. Here, number three, the only acceptable facility is the DME facility that is charted as the one used to establish the DME fix. All right, so that means you can't use a different nav aid. So we're gonna see here in a minute, using it for an ILS, the only facility that you can use is the one that is actually based on that DME. You can't base it on something else. All right. Like I said, the five-letter name has to be contained in the facility. If it's not in the facility, then you have to select the facility itself that is being used to establish the DME fix. All right, and then selecting the DME provided facility as the active GPS waypoint, a pilot is over the fix when the GPS distance from the active waypoint equals the charted DME value. So it works just like your distance measuring equipment, your DME, right? So an aircraft with DME, if it says that you're 10.5 miles from the VOR and you look at your GPS, when it says 10.5, it should be the same. Now realize, DME is going to use slant range where GPS is just ground range. So it's going to be off a little bit depending on how high you are. The FAA understands that when you're shooting an approach, it's negligible. It's, you know, a few tenths of a mile. It's not a big deal. When you're en route, high altitudes, they compensate for that. It's all in that AC-90-108. It says, as well as in the instrument flying handbook, if you want to read about how it's off just a little bit, but it's not a big deal. All right. Big thing is, if you put in the nav aid and you're using it for the distance, that distance is acceptable. All right. So let's talk about the big one. Since all my examiners that I asked are from the Vegas area, this is one that gets students all the time. All right, it's the ILS localizer runway 12 left into North Las Vegas. You guys that aren't flying in Vegas, all over the world, this is same procedures can apply to you as well. So when you're doing your instrument training, look and see if this is if this might happen to you as well. In the Garmin 430, it's a really good unit. What you're going to see here is when you go in and you select an approach, you go to the procedures, select an approach, and it pops up here and tells you, hey, look at this. I got an ILS 12 left. It's got the two GPS approaches. But what happens if I select that ILS 12 left? All right. First, it's going to tell me that the GPS guidance is for monitoring only. So it's going to ask you if you want to activate the approach. What that means is you can't fly the localizer using just the GPS, all right, like you would a GPS approach. So if you activate it doing this way, make sure that you have the correct localizer in there. So 110.7 is our localizer here for IHOG, all right, and it has to be in the VLOC or the VOR localizer mode, all right. So you have to have your CDI set for that, all right. That is acceptable if you do that, all right. Now, what it's going to do is it's going to come down here. Once you activate it, it's going to put that approach into your waypoints in here. You can see I'm still going off of VLOC, so that means all my CDI indications are going to be based off of the actual ILS itself, right? The actual localizer itself. But it's going to give me distance. So in this case, it's going to give me distance from Kigi and from the runway 12 left, all right, as well as the missed approach down here at Tupac. All right. The problem is, if that glide slope is noted out of service or it fails or something like that, and you back yourself up with the localizer, how are you going to identify these step-down fixes? Along with that, how are you going to identify JOCUS as well, all right, outside here? All right, so it's only giving you the information for Kigi as well as your missed approach. Once you pass Kigi here, it's going to sequence over here to the missed approach point, and it's going to start giving you distances from that. All right. So the 6.2 and the 3.5, that's from the actual localizer itself, the localizer antenna, which is on the other end of the runway. All right. You can see here at the missed approach point, it's 0.8 miles away. All right. That's missed approach. When you get to the runway 12 left, it's going to say zero. So what you're going to have to do in order to figure out where JOCUS is, if you're doing it this way, is you're going to sit here and say, okay, well, how far is Jokas from Kigge? Well, it's 3.3 miles. So what you're going to do is when your GPS tells you that you're 3.3 from Kigge, you know that you're at Jokas. All right. Then if you step down inside here, so once you hit Kigge, it's going to go to zero, then it's going to start. It's going to sequence automatically to the missed approach point. Now, if you're not using that glide slope and you're going to use veg cue here, how do you identify that? Well, it's 2.7 from Jakpo, which is 2.7 from here. So you have to add those up, and it's going to be, was that 5.2 miles for this one? Then once you get past that, you can see it's a lot of math, right? And it's a lot of mental stuff that you have to go through. You can do it. It's legal because the waypoints are all in the database, right? But that's a huge pain in the butt, all right? I can't do math that fast. So what I do is, this is the TazTech here, put the NAV facility in as your active waypoint. So what I do is I just go over here and put IHOG in. Forget about loading that ILS approach. You don't have to do that. Just load the IHOG in here. So the IHOG is the four-letter identifier here for the localizer itself. Now what it's going to do is it's going to give you distance from this just like your DME would, all right? So there's no need to do math. When it says that you're at 12.6, you're at Jokas. So when this says 12.6, you're at Jokas. When it says you're at 9.4, you're at Kigge. In this case right here, you can see right now we're at 10.8. So that means I'm halfway between Jokas and Kigge. Makes it easy, right? So this is one of the things that students mess up a lot in Vegas. I'm assuming it's probably all over, trying to figure out your DME distances and stuff like that. So. While this way is legal, putting it in for the using the actual overlay in there, as long as you're following the actual localizer and distances, you have to calculate it. This way, actually putting the nav aid in is by far easier. And when you're already got a handful of collective and cyclic, this is probably the easiest way. You don't want to be trying to calculate and do math while you're trying to navigate the weather as well. All right, so this is what I recommend for all my students, and that's what they do. Last topic here is descent from the runway to the DA or MDA. So 14 CFR 91-175 defines three requirements that must be met before you descend below the MDA or below the DA. So you must always be able to make a descent to landing on the intended runway using normal maneuvers and a normal descent rate. Flight visibility that you observe must meet or exceed the minimums published for the approach, and you must be able to distinctively identify one of the approved visual references for that runway, often called the runway environment. All right, you can group the runway visual references into two groups. The ones that let you descend down to 100 feet above the touchdown zone elevation, and the ones that allow you to land, all right? So if you can see the white approach light system and nothing else, then you can descend down to 100 feet above the touchdown zone elevation regardless of the type of approach you're flying. So if you look here, you've got the white approach lighting system here, right? It's got the sequence flashers. We call that the rabbit. So if you can see that, you can descend on down, all right? But at the 100 foot point, you need other visual references to descend. What are those other references? It's all these things right here, right? It's a whole list of stuff. If you've been studying for your instrument, you should be familiar with these. Your examiner is going to ask you these on your check ride, so make sure you understand these, all right? Different types of approach line system, the runway threshold, all this kind of stuff inside here is what you're going to be looking for, all right? So be able to regurgitate that stuff to your examiner. All right, so your approach chart shows the lights you're going to see in two places. It's going to show it to you at the top of the approach plate. So there's your ALSF 2. It's going to give you your sequence flashers. And it's also going to be at the bottom in your airport diagram right there. So it gives you two places. So if the examiner asks you, hey, what kind of approach lighting system is this going to have? You can see it right there. It shows you exactly what it's going to do. All right. It also tells you over here what kind of visual approach you're going to have. Right. So it's got a PAPI in this case. All right. And then if you need to identify that more, so if he asks you, hey, what's this ALSF2? You can go to the front of your TTPs, and it's going to tell you in the front of your approach book what exactly that gives you. All right? All right. The other thing to remember is the approach is not complete until you land or execute the missed approach. What examiners see is pilots get so excited at the sight of the runway that they duck under the glide path and get dangerously close to trees and other objects. All right, so the examiner says, hey, yep, you break out, you can go visual. So what do the students do? They take off the hood and then they duck underneath that glide path, all right, and they get close. They don't follow that glide path on down to the runway. What the examiners want you to see is continue flying that glide path. Give it a nice stable. You've already been flying a nice stable glide path, especially if you're flying on the ILS. Keep flying that until you get down to the runway to a position where you can actually take over and land normally. Don't go visual and then drop 200 feet or change that descent profile. All right. All right. So that's all the stuff that we talked about there. All right. Hopefully you guys got some questions we can get in before the top of the hour here. And there you go. Obviously, I want to acknowledge these guys. So these are the four DPEs that I talked to. And thanks for all the information they gave me. I tried to whittle it down to keep it within an hour. So there we go.
Subscribe to our channel. Like if you haven't yet. We appreciate that. JoinInstrumentPilot.com is where you can go and check out our instrument course. And I'm going to put a latecomer on the spot. Christopher Hauser just walked in because he was off flying somewhere. So I'm going to make him go up and say hi to Taz real quick. Go on up there. Go back to their camera and we'll introduce. They know each other through videos, but they've never met. So it's kind of cool that Hauser was out flying.
Hey, Hauser, how you doing, buddy?
Good. Nice to meet you.
I was listening to the presentation on my drive over.
Oh, yeah?
So it sounded pretty good. Yes, I was off flying. Sorry, I was supposed to fly yesterday, but weather canceled that. So I had to be with a student today, and I just got back. So.
Awesome. Do you have any instrument questions that you can think of for Tess?
Not at the moment.
Not at the moment. Your brain's probably tired from flying and driving back over here.
I'm flying already. Plus, and I had to drive today. I don't like driving to my student. I'd much rather fly to my student. But
absolutely.
No, I'm glad I made it here because I wanted to meet Taz, and I meant to be here earlier. But like I said, we were supposed to fly yesterday and be off today. But yeah. Weather. Good old northern Indiana weather.
All right, well, we got some more comments here. Not a whole bunch. Thank you for the presentation from Ben. Awesome. That was fantastic. I'm in instrument training right now. That was from James. Rex Jester, great presentation. Thanks. Kilt Dipper, nice. Very helpful. I like the holding pattern cheater program. So those are catching up on our comments. And something I wanted to ask you, Taz, do you want to tell us a little bit about Air Work Las Vegas, just kind of what you guys do down there?
Sure.
Just give them a plug a little bit and let us know what the website is and what their Facebook is.
Yeah.
And just kind of plug what you do down there.
Cool. Yep. So I'm the chief pilot down there. I fly both fixed wing and rotor. More on the fixed wing side just because I got more experience in that, but I do a lot of helicopter as well. We have four airplanes. Actually, five airplanes. We got two Cessnas and an Arrow and a Cherokee, and then we got a Decathlon that we do upset recovery training, spins, all kinds of stuff like that. And then we've got Robinson 22, two Robinson 44s, and a Schweitzer 300 that we do all the helicopter stuff in. Most of the instrument is in the Schweitzer. We do the cross countries in the 44 because the Schweitzer's a little slow, has problems getting up to the MDAs. Or the MEAs out in the mountains, but most of the stuff's in the Schweitzer and the 44s for that. But yeah, we do everything from private all the way up to ATP. So
awesome.
In both ratings, airplane and helicopter, both.
Got a couple questions. Going back to holds, when do you report established? When you first hit the fix or after you've made the PT and are established inbound?
So the ATC says that you are established once you hit that holding fix. So whether you're entering it and then doing your procedure turn, the first time you hit that fix, you're considered established. Your procedure turn, your parallel direct, teardrop, whatever you're doing, that is considered already established in the hold because you're in the holding airspace. So once you're staying in that general area, you're established in the hold. So the first time you hit that fix, you're considered established.
Awesome. And the other one was not a question, but a comment from Dave Faulkner that that I want to mention. Great job, Taz, in tackling tough material. We'll be in LV soon, and lunch is on me when I see you.
Cool.
And I don't know if you've seen a picture of Dave, but nice guy. He's been here with us. And then I just thought something that I'm going to have Gary talk about that we haven't even mentioned yet. And I'm going to let Gary tell you because something huge happened yesterday. So, Gary, you get to go back to your own camera, and you get to show them and tell them what happened yesterday.
Okay, Kenny and I wrote a book for our new course, Remote Pilot 107 Online, and our book was published on Amazon and reached Amazon number one bestseller yesterday. So those of you that dabble in the drones or the small unmanned aircraft in addition to helicopter flying like us now, this is out there and available. And are we still running the deal for the purchase today?
We're not, but we can.
Okay, if anybody's watching this program and you want to go grab a copy for 99 cents, the Kindle version, on Amazon, and show us proof of that transaction and give us a quick review, then we'll give you free access, which is $107 value, to our Remote Pilot online course. Tells you everything you need to know to add Remote Pilot onto your rating with the FAA. And I created a coupon code this morning I'll throw out there for anybody watching. You can get $50 off of any of our membership levels, being yearly or unlimited, whether it be the private, commercial, CFI, or instrument. And this would be the first time we've ever had a discount like this where it's just a one-time $50 off instead of a percentage. You just type holiday 50 into the coupon code section. So this is our last program until after Christmas, so we wanted to do something a little special there, and it's an excellent gift idea for yourself or for a family member or another pilot.
I'm calling that the Renegade Outlaw discount because I woke up this morning and find this email. Gary just decided to give you guys $50 off today. I've never done that, so you can thank Gary Cleveland for the Renegade Outlaw discount.
Yeah, Kenny's mic's not on, but you might have heard him over mine. He's calling it the I've got it on my camera, he's calling this discount the Renegade $50 off discount because since he comes in late, sometimes I just decided to throw it out there and without his permission, and so take advantage of it. $50 off any of the memberships, and we are FAA certified, which means our course can be valuable to even rated pilots who wish to get their phase credits on the WINGS program. So, go back to you for a minute. Do you have anything else?
Got one more question.
There we go.
We got the great job from Dave. James, hold question. When ATC gives you a direction, will they always give you a radial or bearing in line with that cardinal direction?
Okay, if I understand the question correctly, what they're going to do is, if it's not a charted hold, so it's not already on the en route chart or on a approach plate or something like that, then yes, they will give you a radial to hold on. They're not going to just say hold west of the VOR, just hold west. They got to give you something to hold on. So they're going to give you a radial to hold off of, a radial DME to hold off of, or an intersection. They might tell you to hold at an intersection east or west of it, but then that intersection is going to be based on radials themselves. And if they don't, ask them. They're human too, and they make mistakes. Yeah, they should. They should give you a radial.
All right. Well, I guess you're going to come back to me. That's right at 1 hour. We went live on time today. Taz is good luck for us. He showed up, and we hit number one bestseller, and then we started on time, and we're ending on time right at 1 hour. That gets all the questions. A lot of Merry Christmases from a lot of you. Merry Christmas to all of you back out there for everything that you do for us. You are how we are here every day and how we have roofs over our heads and able to come to work and do what we do. So subscribe to the channel if you haven't. Like, share. Keep supporting us on our content. Anybody got anything they want to add before we go, before we click out of here?
Merry Christmas. See you next year from Helicopter Ground.
I hope you've enjoyed our podcast on common instrument check drive mistakes. If you would like to see the video version of this podcast,
simply go to www.helicopterground.com and you can find the related blog post and view the video for free. Remember that we do have a full instrument preparation course in video form available at www.helicopterground.com.
Discover the number one helicopter training system on the web. Welcome to Helicopter Online Ground School. HelicopterGround.com